Hi, this is Rabbi Jeff Sachs of Atid and Web Yeshiva, joining our very large group of folks. Some of you I see are on mobile devices. Web Yeshiva is now available through your mobile devices, so maybe you're watching us on an iPad or an iPhone or something like that. Welcome. I hope that that's a good experience for you. This is the first in our series on Rabbi Soloveitchik and prayer. Over the years, we've studied a number of different writings by Rabbi Soloveitchik, and now, over the next number of weeks, we're going to be looking at some of his thoughts, some of his teachings on the topic of tefillah, of prayer. I'm not going to give a whole review of Rabbi Soloveitchik, who he was, more about him. I know that many of you have been with us in the past. I'm putting up in the chat box now a link to that's just an MP3. Through the archive at Web Yeshiva, you can go back and get the fuller archives. But this is just a one-time class. The MP3 alone would be enough for the purposes of anybody that's interested in some background to the Rav's life and thought and his biography and how his biography and his philosophy overlap or interact. So if you need some kind of background, you can go there. That happened to have been the very first lecture in a series that explored the entirety of his epic essay, The Lonely Man of Faith. I'm not going to go through that whole introduction and review again, but you can look there for some background. I would also suggest, I see that Israel Kashkin is online, one of our fellow students. Israel Kashkin runs a website called therav.net. I'm pretty sure that's the link, which is a resource for Rabbi Soloveitchik, resources on Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik, on essays and lectures and writings, and I think even some recordings and some great pictures and things like that. So I recommend that also for people that are interested in some Rabbi Soloveitchik backgrounds. But of course, here he is. Here's the Rav, as he was affectionately known, Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik, who lived from 1903 to 1993. This book, Worship of the Heart, Essays on Jewish Prayer, which was published by Ketav and the Meotzar Harav Library. I see that, thank you, Alan, for putting a link to the book on the Ketav website. I happen to notice that on the Amazon website, it seems to either be, it's available, but it's not readily available. It also seems a little pricey. There is a version of it for free online on the Google Books site, which some people like to use. It's not the entire book, but it's I think they have a lot of it up on the Google Books site. Alan points out that on the Ketav website, it's even cheaper than on the Amazon site. Those of you that are here in Jerusalem, all of these books, books published in the United States in English that have to be shipped here, they're all pricey. They're usually available in the large bookstores that sell English Jewish books, particularly Pomerantz in the center of Jerusalem. But you have to check to see if it's not cheaper to buy it online in America and either have it sent or have someone bring it. I know that many of you are here with us in Israel, and I know that some of you are actually in Europe. I'm not precisely sure. I really, really recommend, getting your hands on the book, borrowing it or buying it, used, which is also possible to do from different websites online. We'll be using it over the course of the next weeks. I will, of course, make certain passages and scans available through the website for our use, but really, I do recommend getting the book itself. But tonight, we are actually not going to be talking, we are going to be talking about Rabbi Soloveitchik, but not about the Rav, Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik, but about his grandfather, Reb Chaim Soloveitchik, or Reb Chaim Brisker, the Brisker Rav. It's hard to give a one-sentence background to Reb Chaim. Reb Chaim lived from 1853 to 1918. He taught in the renowned yeshiva of the Luzhin at one point, spent a significant part of his career as the Rav of a town called Brisk. A visit to the internet will provide some biographical background on Reb Chaim Brisker, renowned for his piety, renowned for his erudition. He was the progenitor, the founder, the inventor of a school of Talmudic analysis, which came to be known as Brisker Lumdus, the Torah of Brisk, nicknamed after the town that he lived in, as was the fashion. Joel Nowicki, our good friend who's joining us from northern Poland, points out that Reb Chaim is buried in Warsaw next to the Nitziv. I was in Warsaw about a year and a half ago, visiting Joel, but I unfortunately did not have a chance to visit the Jewish cemetery in Warsaw. This Brisker method, we also don't have time to fully explore what it is, but it was a new way of Talmudic analysis. There were various features that were associated with it and which distinguished it from the conventional way of Talmud study, which was in fashion in Europe up to that point, but it very much reoriented the way that large swaths of the yeshiva world and the Jewish world approached Jewish learning, Talmud study in particular. A number of years ago, I wrote a little essay. It was really an annotated translation of something that Rabbi Soloveitchik himself had written, which is a description of what the Brisker method is. Posting it here in the chat. It's available on the yutorah.org website if you search for Sacks and Brisk, Sacks being my name, S-A-K-S, and Brisk, B-R-I-S-K, or B-R-I-S-K-E-R method. You'll easily find it, or just by clicking on that link, you can download the PDF for those of you that are interested in that background. And just before we get into it, I'll also mention a website. It's the website of a book that was, I believe, self-published by a young man named Rabbi Yus, who put out a book called Understanding Reb Chaim. It's a translation and an analysis of a number of passages from Reb Chaim's monumental work, posthumously a volume called Chidushei Rabbeinu Chaim Halevi, the Torah Insights, the Torah Novellae of Reb Chaim, was published by Reb Chaim's sons. This Rabbi Yus translated a number of those pieces with introductory material, etc. The piece that we'll be looking at this evening is also featured there. It's an interesting book. I had an opportunity to interview him for a kind of podcast that we do about notable Jewish books. And if you go to that website, you can listen to the conversation that I had with Rabbi Yus about his book. But for people that are interested in more on Reb Chaim and how it works and what it is, you can take a look at that book also. Jewish prayer, tefillah, is an obviously rich and complex and profound phenomena, component of religious life, challenge to religious life, obviously not just an educational challenge for teachers and for parents, but a personal challenge for most of us to pray with meaning and to invest our prayers with feeling and to frankly, to benefit from the opportunity to pray. Those of us that do pray on a daily basis, on three times a day daily basis, all face the danger of falling into some kind of rote behavior pattern, and that's something that has to be resisted. And the challenge of doing that is probably one of the central challenges, one of the central challenges to religious life, whatever form of religious life you practice. All Jewish religious life puts prayer as a central daily ritual. Interestingly, Rabbi Soloveitchik was in many ways a pioneer in exploring what all of that means, of taking the topic of prayer and turning it into the magnet, the home address for a wealth of both philosophical, theological exploration on one hand, Talmudic and halachic exploration on the other hand, and frankly, odd as it may sound, almost anthropological exploration on the third hand. There is no third hand. By anthropological, I mean the study of man, or of humanity, I should say, trying to weed out the gendered language, which was so common in the years in which the Rav was writing. Many people have pointed out, I've mentioned in the past, that in some ways, Rabbi Soloveitchik is not a theologian, theologian being someone that studies and explores God. He's much more interested in humanity. If you look at The Lonely Man of Faith, this comes through loud and clear. He's much more concerned with how the religious life is played out down here than he is in trying to ask certain almost unexplorable questions about how things work in the supernal realms. And in that regard, tefillah is a very rich vein to mine in exploring religious thought, because it's played out in the hearts and minds of actual flesh and blood human beings. And Rabbi Soloveitchik dedicated many significant portions of his written canon to the topic of Jewish prayer. This book, which is a collection of essays, some of them translations from material that was published in Hebrew already in Rabbi Soloveitchik's lifetime, and others edited manuscripts or transcripts of other things. This is only one cut into his treatment of the topic of tefillah, of prayer. But he also would dedicate significant time and thought and analysis to the topic of prayer in the wearing his other hat, the hat of the Rosh Yeshiva, not of the public intellectual, not of the Jewish philosopher, but the hat of the Rosh Yeshiva, of the Talmud scholar, of the teacher of Talmud. Conventionally, there were topics that drew a greater share of attention in the shiur room, in the Beit Midrash, on the curricula of yeshivot, and topics that, frankly, drew less attention. And one of the things that the Rav did in his long career as a teacher of Torah was to shake up that curriculum a little bit, to expand the topics that a Rosh Yeshiva would explore, both in the shiur with the yeshiva students, with the rabbinical students at Yeshiva University, but also in the many other venues in which he would teach. In Boston, in the synagogue in Boston where he served as the rabbi, in the synagogue, the Moriah Synagogue in Manhattan, where he gave a weekly shiur for many, many, many years to lay people, to very learned and intelligent and engaged lay people, but to lay people, public addresses, both in front of Jewish as well as in front of non-Jewish audiences. You'll remember, those of you that were with us for the long exploration of the Lonely Man of Faith, we remember the Lonely Man of Faith for its very stark contrast between Adam 1 and Adam 2, the description of man as put forth in the first chapter of Genesis versus that put forth in the second chapter of Genesis, and the different contrasts that exist when you put them side by side, and the process of trying to resolve those conflicts by explaining that they describe different components of the human personality, different topologies of what the religious personality is. But because we all remember that, and I hope you do all remember that, sometimes we overlook the fact that in the middle of the essay, there's this very significant treatment of the topic of prayer. And if we were to excise that alone, it could almost stand as a standalone essay on the Jewish view of prayer. I'm not going to review that in this series, but I do point that out to you because you see how the topic of prayer fit in so many different ways across the canon of Rabbi Soloveitchik's thought. But that essay, The Lonely Man of Faith, I remind you, was given in its initial form in a few different varieties, sometimes in front of non-Jewish audiences. So in many different formats, in many different platforms, he explored again and again and again from different directions this topic of prayer. But because of that, it was something that was very allowed for the display of great creativity and innovation, because it was a fresh, uncharted territory in the world of the explorations of Jewish thought and philosophy and how it played out in religious life, you know, over the greater part of the 20th century. But those of you that were with us for the Lonely Man of Faith series, and those of you that will revisit that introduction that I posted a link to, will recall the long fourth footnote in the Ish HaLacha, I just muted everyone because we have a lot of people online. I can't leave all the microphones open, it creates too much static. But if anyone would like to speak, please feel free to open your microphone or to raise your hand or chat to me, let me know. I'd like to hear what you all have to say as we move along. You, of course, can also post your comments in the chat, either to me privately or to the entire audience. And while I've taken this break, I'll ask you, if you have a webcam, please hit the icon next to your name on the participants panel so that we can see you. It greatly, greatly enhances the experience of all being together if we can see one another. I know it certainly enhances my own teaching to be able to see you wherever it is that you're joining us from. If you don't have a webcam, I really encourage you to get one. The cheapest webcam you can find will be more than enough for what we need for our purposes here on Web Yeshiva, and it greatly enhances what we have to do. Yes, Jack, your microphone is open.
Now, what I'm interested in so much, my Rav, my Beit Knesset, Rav Daniel Biller, is a great fan of Rav Soloveitchik, and he often quotes Lonely Man of Faith in all his drushes, and, you know, I want to learn more about Rav Soloveitchik, and I'm very interested in your lectures.
Okay, wonderful. Well, where are you joining us from?
From Ranana.
Oh, from Ranana. Well, welcome. Ranana. Not so far away. Okay.
No,
well,
not so far away.
Well, again, like I said, some of the background information is in that one lecture that I posted, and in the Web Yeshiva, if you go to webyeshiva.org under archives, you can find the archives of, I don't know, there's probably about 40 different lectures on Rabbi Soloveitchik's thought that I've given. There have been a few other teachers in Web Yeshiva that have taught as well. You can find a variety of things on our site and, of course, on some other sites as well.
I'd like to ask you another question, please.
Sure.
What is Rav Soloveitchik's relationship with Chabad? Did he approve of the method of tefillah, which is a little bit more, not exactly the, you know, the type of prayer that we used to as Ashkenazim? It's more
ecstatic prayer.
Wow. But it's not exactly in keeping with what we know, you know, from our sort of more sage way of, you know.
Right. So Jack asked about the Rav's connection to Chabad, although I imagine we can extrapolate your question to Chassidut in general, not limiting it to Chabad. The Rav and the Lubavitcher Rebbe, Zichrono Levracha, the late Lubavitcher Rebbe, had a personal relationship going back to their days in Berlin. As young men, they both studied in Berlin. They knew each other way back then. And then in New York, they maintained not a close relationship, but certainly an acquaintance, and they would visit from time to time. There was one famous occasion in which the Rav went to a Chabreng, to one of those, you know, Hasidic festive gatherings that I think was in honor of the Rebbe's, I'm going to say, 70th birthday, although 75th birthday, some special occasion. And the Rav went, and he attended. There's even a video of it, which you can get on the YouTube or something like that online on the Chabad site and watch it. And he had regard for him. In terms of Chassidut in general, that's a more complicated question. The Rav, Jack, I've just muted you so that we don't have any static. The Rav actually had high regard for many components of Chassidut, particularly the Tanya. I'll just mention this story by way of parenthetically, and then we really should get cracking on our study tonight. When the Rav was a young boy, he lived in a town called Chaslovich. His father was the Rav of this little town called Chaslovich, which was a town of Lubavitcher Hasidim, of Chabad Hasidim, although the practice was to hire a misnagdish, a non-Hasidic rabbi of the town. For a short while, Rabbi Soloveitchik studied in Cheder, in the traditional one-room schoolhouse in the town when he was a little boy. And the teacher, himself a Chabad Hasid, would, instead of teaching Gemara, would teach Tanya, the pillar text of Hasidut, of Hasidism, and of Chabad Hasidism in particular. And he would, you know, kind of hide it, you know, inside the Gemara in case anyone came along and no one would know he was really teaching Chabad. Long story short, it was discovered that young Joseph B., young Yosher Be'er Soloveitchik, was not progressing in a satisfactory way in his Talmud study, and he was removed from this cheder, partially at the insistence of his grandfather, who found his studies to be wanting. And at that point, he never returned to formal education. He learned at home one-on-one with his father for the rest of his schooling career. But he often said that exposure to Chassidus and to Chabad and to the Tanya in particular left a lasting impression on his, I guess, on his soul. And on occasion, he himself would teach Tanya as a supplement to Gemara, not in place of the Gemara. So that's one short story, although it doesn't reveal his attitudes towards prayer. One imagines his attitudes toward prayer are a little more conventional, although as we go along, we may see that there are other elements in it. Let's look at what Reb Chaim had to say about tefillah. Now, I've decided to start with Reb Chaim, although I imagine that some of you may be familiar with this with what we'll be studying tonight. But it's worthy of review. But also because it's a foundational teaching in our understanding of prayer. Rabbi Soloveitchik himself uses the ideas time and time again in his own presentation of tefillah, in his own presentation of prayer, and on occasion accepts it with two hands, on occasion merely with one hand. There are elements of what we'll study from Reb Chaim, from his grandfather, that Rabbi Soloveitchik did not accept, or could not accept, in developing his own philosophy of prayer. But let's save that for another time, and let's look at what Reb Chaim did. The Chidushei Rebbeinu Chaim Halevi, Reb Chaim's teachings, as they're recorded in his one principal book, are halachic essays using the Rambam, Maimonides. And Maimonides is Mishneh Torah, his great code of Jewish law, as the starting point. Very often the piece that we'll look at tonight is a classical construct. He looks at two passages in the Rambam, in Maimonides, both of them in Hilchot Tefillah, the laws of prayer, and he highlights what appears to be a contradiction, an internal contradiction within Maimonides' own thought, or his own rulings. And then Reb Chaim's analysis is to show you that, of course, really there is no contradiction here. Really, there are two components, or two aspects, or two dinim, in Yiddish, tzvei dinim, two laws at work, or two guiding principles at work that are not in conflict with each other. It's not a contradiction, but they highlight two different aspects. Now, this idea in the halachic realm should be familiar to those of you that have studied with us in the past. After all, isn't that what the Rav was doing in The Lonely Man of Faith? The Lonely Man of Faith, looking not at legal passages, halachic passages, looks at the first two chapters of Bereshit, Book of Genesis, notices that the story of the creation of man is recounted twice. And if you do a careful reading of Genesis 1 versus Genesis 2, you're going to see that they're very different stories. And if you try to analyze the personality of Adam, of the first man as a topology for all of mankind, you're going to notice that we're talking about very different people. Bible scholars make a lot of hay out of this. Bible critics, rather, make a lot of hay out of this. And we'll say that maybe we're talking about, God forbid, more than one author, that there were two different accounts written, and a later editor put them together. Rabbi Soloveitchik says nothing of the kind. We're talking about two different components of man, two different aspects of the human personality. And it's recounted twice in order to give you a richer, fuller description. Like looking at a profile from one side and then looking at the profile from the other side to give you a sense of the larger three-dimensionality of the whole thing. So here in Hilchot Tefillah, let's look at what the Rambam has to say. The Rambam, Maimonides, remember, greatest Jewish thinker and halachist, 12th century, born in Spain, travels, lands up in Egypt. The Rambam, in his great encyclopedia of Halakha, the Mishneh Torah, writes in the fourth chapter of the Laws of Prayer, Chamishad varim ma'akvin et ha'tfila af al pi shehigi hazmana. There are five things which are ma'akev, which prevent, which block the accomplishment of the prayer act, even though you might be praying at the proper time. Without going into all of them, they are taharat yadayim, that your hands should be clean and pure, kisui ha'erva, that you should be properly dressed and certainly not in the presence of others who are improperly dressed, who are exposed in an improper way. It's not proper to pray in front of someone who's naked. The taharat makom hatfila, the place you're davening in, has to be clean. Dvarim hachufzim oto, and you can't have things that are distracting you. And the fifth thing, kavanat halev, kavana, intention of the heart. Kavana is a hard thing to describe. And it's one of those things, you know it when you see it. But it's not true. I mean, you can see it. You can see what you think is kavana, but since one never really knows what's going on inside the heart and mind of another, it may only appear to be. One imagines that you know it when you experience it. And it's hoped that in a career of serious davening, we've all experienced it from time to time. True intent, true focus. The word kavanah means directionality, focus. Kivun lechavein means to be on the mark, to be in the right direction. The absence of kavanat alev, intention of the heart, even though you stand up and you put your feet together and you face Jerusalem and you recite the words at the right time, but the absence of kavanat alev is enough to invalidate the prayer. So the Rambam then goes on to say, kavanat alev ketzad. Well, what is kavanat alev? Kol tfila she'ena bekavana, ena tfila. Any prayer which is lacking in kavana is, by definition, not a prayer. V'in hitpalel blo kavana, if one prayed without intent, choser mitpalel b'kavana. I will use the term kavana throughout our study without stopping to explain it. I trust that you understand what I mean by kavana. But I'm not going to pause to define it, translate it, explain it each time. I'm just putting that little asterisk in our conversation now. So if you prayed with kavanah, you prayed. If you prayed without kavanah, then you didn't pray. So if you prayed without kavanah, it's as if you didn't pray, and you have to go back and pray again. Matzad da'ato mishubeshet v'libo tarut. If your mind is distracted, confused, your heart is heavy and preoccupied, asur lo lehitpalel ad shetityashev da'ato. You can't lechatchila, from the outset, one should not pray if he's in a condition, or she's in a condition, where there's no chance you'll achieve kavana. Lefichach, ketzad hi kavana. He mentions this idea that if you know that you can't pray with kavana, or if you've just returned from a long journey, you should go a few days even without praying. That's not the normative halacha today, for reasons we'll come back to. But then he says, "Ketzad hi hakavana? She'ifareh libo mikol machshavot, clear your mind of all thoughts, v'yireh atzmo ke'ilu hu omed lifnei hashchina." And you should envision yourself as if you are standing in front of God, in front of the divine presence. I'm sorry, was there somebody that wanted to say something? Did somebody raise their hands? Yes? Yeah, Jack, go ahead.
Kavana is very much concentration, and you're standing, your tefillah is directed towards HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And therefore, you know, if you're not trying to daven with Kavana, then you're not actually davening at all. It's concentration in any sphere. You know, for an examination, if you can't concentrate, you're likely to fail. And I think it's just a general state of mind that one has to go into tefillah with kavana. Otherwise, it's not going to serve any purpose.
Yeah, well, that's essentially what the Rambam is saying. That's essentially what the Rambam is saying. But it seems that kavana is definitional to prayer, and how much of the prayer needs kavana? Kol tefillah. The whole prayer. Now, let's pause for a moment. When we say tefillah, let's be clear. We're talking about the Amidah. In halachic literature, the word tefillah is used in a very specific sense. It means the Amidah, what we call the Shmona Esrei, the standing silent prayer. It does not mean Shema. It does not mean Ashrei Yoshrei Vitecha or Aleinu L'Shabeach. It means the Amidah, the standing silent prayer, which is the centerpiece of the daily tefillah. The way we daven, if you look at the Siddur today, there are a lot of other things that we do. Some of them may be even more obligatory. It's one of the interesting things that Shema, the recitation of Shema, which at least on one level, according to all opinions, is a Torah obligation, the recitation of Shema, at least the first pasuk, if not the first paragraph, to recite that twice a day is a Torah obligation. It's a mitzvah min haTorah. Prayer, on the other hand, is the way we pray. The Amidah is certainly only dirabanan, only rabbinic in obligation. But even the essential core level of whatever prayer is, when you peel away all of the rabbinic obligations that have been superimposed on it, even that core level of prayer is a debate about what level of obligation it is. That's an interesting machloket, which we'll touch upon in passing elsewhere. It's an interesting machloket, difference of opinion between the Rambam and the Ramban, between Maimonides and Nachmanides, both of whom agree that prayer is a Torah obligation, but they disagree about what the scope of that obligation is. Maimonides believes that there's a Torah obligation for daily prayer, once a day, but there's no Torah obligation when during the day to say it, what to say, the whole idea of a set prayer, of a set text, of a set time, all of that is rabbinic. But there's a daily obligation to pray, to somehow communicate with God. This is all laid out in the first chapter of the Hilchot Tefillah. The Ramban disagrees. The Ramban says there is a Torah obligation to pray, but not on a daily basis. There's a Torah obligation to pray be'et tzara, at times of distress, perhaps personal distress, certainly national distress. There's a time to call out to God. But on a regular day, everything is okay. You have a little money in the bank. You have food in the fridge. No one's coming to pillage your town. A regular day like that, maybe there is no Torah obligation to pray according to Nachmanides. Miriam asks in the chat, so Psukei de Zimra are preparation that doesn't take kavana? ? Well, yes, obviously Psukei de Zimra is preparation, a kind of like warm-up exercise for the more central parts of the prayer. I wouldn't say that they don't require kavanah. Kavana is desirable in everything that we do, but on the level of whether or not one has fulfilled the obligation, the mere recital of the Psukei Dezimra seems to be enough to have fulfilled the rabbinic obligation of reciting Psukei Dezimra. But the level of Kavana required for the Amidah seems to be obviously greater. But that's the paradox, because the Amidah, the way that we daven it, according to all opinions, is Dirabanan, even though there might be a Torah obligation encrusted around the Amidah. Could be, though, that the Amidah requires a greater level of Kavana than the Shema. And the Shema, according to all opinions, is a Torah obligation. Jack, I'm gonna mute you again. You seem to keep getting unmuted. If there's something you want to say, so we're happy to hear from you, but otherwise let's keep your mic muted because it causes a little bit of static. If you do want to speak up in class, it's preferable you should have one of these headset microphones that would allow you to speak without causing static. So this is the first passage in the Rambam, which seems to be saying that prayer requires kavana. Without kavana, you do not fulfill your obligation. It, in fact, prayer without a kavana is not a prayer. Eina tefillah. Definitionally, it's not what it's meant to be. And it seems that the entirety of the Amidah requires kavana. However, the Rambam in the 10th perek says something very different. He says, Mishit palel v'lo kiven et libo, someone who prayed and did not have kavana, yachzor v'yit palel b'kavana. Okay, so far that's similar to the 4th chapter, where we said, if you pray without kavana, you have to repeat the prayer. So here, it says the same thing. If you daven without kavana, you should repeat the prayer. The in kivein et libo bevracha rishona shuv eino sarich. However, if you mustered kavana for the first paragraph, beyond that, you don't need. I mean, you should try, but if ex post facto, bidiavad, you prayed and only could muster kavanah during the first of the 19 brachot, that's enough. Not ideal. That's not what we strive for. But on the level of examining whether or not you fulfilled your obligations in prayer, kavanah during the first paragraph, says the Rambam, is sufficient. Tehillaleah asks a question about, isn't there a teaching that repetition by its nature causes a lack of kavanah? I think you may be referring to an idea that we have already mentioned in the Gemara, v'ho'idna ein chozrin b'shvil chisaron kavanah. That nowadays, there seems to be this notion in rabbinic literature that nowadays our level of kavanah, we're not speaking about any one individual, but we're speaking about the population as a whole. In general, our kavanah is not so good, so that if you daven and you didn't have kavanah, you shouldn't repeat the prayer, because our assumption being that if you daven without kavanah the first time, chances are you'll just daven again without kavanah the second time. But here we're talking about not on the level of the practical, but the level of the idea. So there seems to be this contradiction in the Rambam. In the first chapter, in the first passage, it seems that one needs kavanah for the entire thing. And in the second passage, it seems that one need have kavanah only for the first paragraph. Now, there are a lot of different ways to explain this seeming contradiction. Well, first of all, you can explain it by saying there is no contradiction. one is, lays down the principle, and the second lays down the practice. One lays down the ideal, and the other lays down the real. One lays down the preferred method, and the other is examining the bidyavad, the ex post facto. Once one hasn't had enough kavanah, well, how much lack of kavanah is required in order to invalidate the tefillah? I mean, there are, I don't know, how many words are in the Shemona Esrei? That would be an interesting homework assignment. How many words are there in the Shemona Esrei? On the average weekday Shemona Esrei, we just, here in Israel, we just started reciting the V'tein Tal U'matar Levracha, instead of V'tein Bracha, V'tein Tal U'matar Levracha. So you have an extra 2 words during this half of the year that we don't have the other half of the year. But on average, how many words are there in the average Amidah? That would be an interesting question. I mean, I just Googled it to see. I'm sure someone can figure this out. It is a knowable question. But let's say there are 1,000 words in the Amidah. So that means that if I have Kavanah for 999 of them, but for one of them I tuned out for just a moment, so according to the 4th chapter here, it invalidates the whole thing. But according to the 10th chapter, as long as you had Kavanah for that first paragraph, so, and then you like went on autopilot, like you could imagine such a thing happening. Not to you, I'm sure, but to the person standing next to you in shul, where like you're praying, and then like you become aware that you've been flying on autopilot for a while. And you're like, you don't even know like where you are. You know, like you say, like, who am I? Where am I? It's a TLA, you're asking like halachic questions. Like if you didn't have kavanah, can and should you listen to the Chazarat HaShatz, to the repetition, in order to, like, as a backup? Maybe. But I'm going to leave the level of the practical halacha off the table for the moment. Reb Chaim did not adopt any of these solutions to resolving the contradiction. And he came up with a very different and very innovative response. We're not going to have time now to go through the whole thing, although those of you that are interested before next week are welcome to make a go of it. Or again, in that volume that I mentioned, Understanding Reb Chaim, which, you know, may be available on Amazon or through that website, you can also get access to it in English. It's not exactly a translation; it's more of an adaptation in that book. But Reb Chaim points to one component: this idea of Eina Tfila. Kol tfila she'ena b'kavana, eina tfila. I'm going to ask you to think about this. I mean, I assume that some of you have studied this piece from Reb Chaim Brisker before, in which case, thinking about it will require you to remember, which is sometimes harder than thinking from something from scratch. But those of you that, for whom this is all new, then really you're very fortunate, because you can think creatively. Short of trying to resolve the contradiction by saying it's not really a contradiction between these two passages in the Rambam, if you want to take the kind of brisker approach and say that really it's highlighting 2 different elements of tefillah, which is, of course, what Reb Chaim's going to do. He's going to say that for one component of tefillah, kavanah is required for the whole thing. And for a different aspect of kavanah, less is required. And that's how he's going to resolve the contradiction within the Rambam. Well, what might those aspects be? What might be the 2 different components of kavana that exist, one kind of superimposed on the other, so that we can then bifurcate them. We can split them up, as if you could put like kavana into a centrifuge and spin it around and break it up into its disparate parts and say, well, there's kavana A and there's kavana B, and for kavana type A we require a lot, and for kavana part B we can be satisfied merely with a little, although we'd always like to have the whole thing. Well, what might those two levels of kavana be? So part of it has to do with this definition of what kavana is. So let me ask you a question before we go. Every mitzvah has its own definition. We just, a couple of weeks ago, just finished Sukkot. So let me ask you, think about it for a moment. On Sukkot, we take the four species, the lulav, the etrog, the hadas, the arava, these four different types of fruits and plants, and we shake them around. Part of the davening. If on Sukkot, instead of taking a lulav and an etrog, I take a lulav and a lemon. Now, a lemon looks a lot like an etrog. Did I fulfill my obligation or not? No. Correct. I mean, everybody's answering no. It's obvious. But why don't I fulfill my obligation when I take a lemon instead of an etrog? You know, the Mishnah says if I have an etrog and it's chaser, if I take a bite out of the etrog and I use that half-eaten etrog, I cut it in half and I put half into my tea. And I take the other half and I try shaking it with my lulav, I'm not yotze. And if I take a lemon instead of an etrog, I'm similarly not yotze. I similarly haven't fulfilled my obligation. Are these two sides of the same coin? Or is there a difference between these two different invalid etrogim? What do you think? Okay, Tila Lay, do you have a microphone?
Yeah.
Okay, so explain what you mean.
So a lemon is the type of item used, but the partial etrog is the quality of the item used. I'm not sure if I can relate that back to tefillah.
Oh, sorry, I was muted. I'm sorry. Don't worry about relating it back to tefillah. But it's true. Miriam mentions you can't use a lemon because the masorah is that the Torah is referring to an esrog. That's true. But even forget that question of how we know it's an esrog. Let's take that for granted. When you take an etrog that's dried out, which is also one of the reasons that a etrog is pasul, is invalid, or you take an etrog with a bite taken out of it, it's an etrog, but it's an invalid etrog. When you take a lemon, it's not an invalid etrog. It's not an etrog. Definitionally, something is wrong with the mitzvah. It's not that you've done the mitzvah, but did it in a way where there was something wrong with the performance, which is the case of using a pasul lulav or a pasul etrog. If you take, instead of a lulav and etrog, you take a tennis racket and a tennis ball and you shake it, it's not that you've done the mitzvah in an invalid way. By definitionally, something is lacking. And there's a difference between the two cases. And that may be reflected in the case of tefillah here. That maybe there are two different ways of having an invalid etrog. One is you have a bite taken out of it, and the other is you don't have an etrog at all. And then it's not an invalid etrog. It's as if you didn't do it, because you violated the very definition of what the mitzvah is. Think about it as we move along. People are already posting in the chat, essentially, in one line, the point of the Reb Chaim, that without Kavanah, it's not even a prayer. It's the equivalent of taking a lemon. This is the track that Reb Chaim will take, which we'll look at in greater detail next week by way of getting into the larger analysis of the topic of Rabbi Soloveitchik on prayer. In the meantime, think about it. Anybody can tell me how many words there are in the Amidah. I'm embarrassed I hadn't looked that up before, that I didn't know it. So you'll get extra credit on the final exam. That's a joke, of course. There's my email again in the chat. I look forward to your thoughts and your feedback and your comments and your questions as we move along. If you're able to get access to the book, Worship of the Heart, Essays on Jewish Prayer by Rabbi Joseph E. Soloveitchik, edited by Rabbi Shalom Carmi, it's a worthy addition to your Jewish bookshelf. And in the meantime, try to think about these questions that we've put forth tonight, because they're going to help us organize our thinking on the topic as we move through the question of Jewish prayer, and then expanding it to questions of other things, like the Shema, etc. Nice being back with all of you. Glad, I know that some of you are on the iPads, etc. For those of you that are new, or certainly new to me, new to my classes, I welcome the opportunity to get to know you and to learn with you. And you can please, at minimally, just drop me an email and let me know who you are, where you're from, what your interests are, etc. That will help my own thinking about how to organize things as we move along. I'll stay online for a little while if anybody has any questions. I'll turn off the recorder now. And if not, we will...